This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And today is the 30th of June, the end of another month, time for another Journalists Roundtable. And we've got some similar issues to talk about because, as it turns out, the pandemic continues. Dave Thompson is our Prairie Public News Director. He always joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Dave, welcome again.
Thank you, Doug.
Monica Hannon, also in Bismarck, the managing editor at KFYR-TV. Monica, thanks for being with us today.
And thank you for asking me.
And Dave Kolpak with the Associated Press. He's the Fargo correspondent. Dave, a pleasure to have you back as well.
Thank you. Always great to be here.
Let's talk about the big issue, the big story, the thing that dominates the news cycle 24/7. That's the pandemic. We've got a North Dakota perspective here. And I think one of the perspectives that is unique to some places in this country is the use of masks and social distancing to protect others. And in North Dakota, Dave, this is Dave Thompson. This is a kind of an interesting result.
It is an interesting result. We do not have mandatory masks, but if you go into some retailers, they're asking you to wear masks. There's nobody forcing you to, but you know, I've gone to a couple retailers around, and the staff is all wearing masks, and I try to wear masks. But not everybody is wearing masks. And I know there was a little discussion at the Fargo City Commission last night about whether maybe Fargo should look at a mandatory mask ordinance of some sort. It didn't go very far, let's put it that way.
Well, they're talking about it in other cities, and other cities have imposed it, although we're doing this sort of city by city, state by state, because the federal government has essentially said, you know, you all work it out yourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Dave Kolpak here, and I, you know, anecdotally living in Fargo myself, you know, frankly, I'm appalled I try not to get out. I have heart disease, frankly, and my wife prefers that I stay home. When I do go out, I wear N95 masks. But, you know, grocery stores and drug stores are a couple places I've visited, and I'm pretty amazed at how few people are wearing masks. And I think we all heard the governor's impassioned speech a while back about mask shaming. And frankly, I might be a little self-conscious, but I felt that too. In a lot of respects. And that at times, I know, you know, Cass County, mainly Fargo, is the hot spot. And sometimes I wonder if we're just fortunate for some reason, you know, either by the fact we have so few people, but, you know, our crucial numbers, deaths, although no death is good, and hospitalizations are low. I wonder if we're just lucky sometimes, just because I really don't think everybody is being that responsible.
No, I think that the big issue is that we do feel like we kind of live in a bubble here. But in Burleigh County, you know, we've gone to red here this week. So there are more cases, more active cases. I think, Dave, 65, I think, is people that are actively sick now.
I think that's correct, yes.
Yeah. So I think that sounds like such a low number. But I do think that the mask shaming thing is either everybody does it or nobody does it around here anyway.
Well, Clay Jenkinson was talking about that when we were discussing one of his new books. It's about epidemics and the history and literature around them. And he was talking about flying out of Portland, Oregon, or Denver, Colorado, and flying into Bismarck and saying, you know, the difference between those two big airports and the smaller one in Bismarck is night and day. Everybody's wearing a mask at these other places, but he lands in Bismarck and very few people are. And I can say, as Dave Kolpak did, that I go into stores, particularly supermarkets, and everybody who works there is wearing a mask, but not that many people who shop there are. And I think it's a reminder that there are people of a certain age, and I would be among them, for whom this is particularly an issue. And nursing homes are where most of the deaths have been in North Dakota, and most of the deaths in Cass County, for that matter. So this is a serious issue that seems to have become strangely politicized.
It has, and, you know, in a lot of people are saying that wearing a mask is a matter of individual responsibility. So that's one argument. And another argument is it shows that it's a sign of weakness, like Gibbs from NCIS would say. if you wear a mask, it's a sign of weakness. But, well, you know, it isn't, though, because really what you're doing when you're wearing a mask, you're protecting others in case you have COVID. And that's a big deal that people should remember, is that a mask will help you, but it will help your fellow man more.
It's more of a respect for others than it is an exhibit of your rights. So I think it's an important distinction to be made. Let's talk about the impact on business as usual, businesses in particular. I'm looking at a place like Minot that has had Hostfest canceled, the state fair canceled, big events for that community. The oil business is in, has dropped abruptly for various reasons, the pandemic among them. So business as usual is not the case.
Oh, no. You think about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. That's true even for those of us who are out working, because at KFYR, only half of us fewer than half of us are in the building. Those who do come in, we go in wearing masks. They take our temperature. They've modified the building so that you've got the air circulation, cleaning all the time. And it's been difficult, we've had to reorganize everything that we've done in order to keep our program on the air. And I would imagine it's the same for most other large businesses as well.
Prairie Public is like that. I actually work in my basement in South Fargo more often than I'm downtown at the studio, as I am today.
And it's interesting because I think, again, part of the reason, because our case numbers have been pretty spread out, we've been probably just generally affected less than most other states. You see all these surveys come out that say, North Dakota ranks 3 or number 4 in terms of how they've been able to manage this and keep their businesses running. But, I don't think we'll really understand the true effect of this for several months yet.
Well, we know
these businesses.
We know unemployment is high everywhere across the nation. We have been, protected a little bit from that. It's still higher than usual in North Dakota, but there are places in this country where unemployment is absolutely crushing people, and that affects business too. You don't spend money if you don't have it.
Right, and our numbers were so high early on because of the oil people that got laid off. Back in March and April, it was really ugly, but since then, we seem to be holding on as well as can be expected, as far as I can tell.
Well, Bismarck is near the oil patch, and of course, Monica, your people at KFYR-TV are looking at that aspect of the state's economy regularly. What can you tell us?
Well, I know that every time we see Lynn Helms come on, he looks nervous and upset. But I would have to say that if you look at Watford City, which was growing by leaps and bounds, and they seem to be optimistic and that they're growing their community. But I know that there's a great deal of concern.
Well, there's also the concern about the lack of activity and abandoned wells, isn't there?
Well, right. They're capping wells and waiting, I guess. I'm not really huge into that area, so I don't want to misspeak. But I can say that when we do report on it, there is always a great deal of concern. For instance, in Williston, they built this new airport, and then flights kind of came to a halt there for a while. And so they're building their economy. I think they started their buildup and hoping that things would go well and assuming that they would. And I think that they're still on that trajectory and hoping that things will come back. It isn't just the pandemic that's caused them problems, of course. It's been the drop in oil prices and what's going on in the Middle East and between, Russia, Saudi Arabia. All those things kind of converged at one time. And I did feel a sense of panic for a while there. I think that they try to sound hopeful, but they're realistic as well.
Well, I'm thinking about the car travel that has been somewhat curtailed by the pandemic. We don't have ocean liners cruising everywhere anymore. And air travel, as you referenced, Monica, has plummeted. It's come back a bit. It was down like 10% of normal at one point, and I think it's coming up to about 25 or 30% of normal in the state now. But nevertheless, it's hardly business as usual.
No, that's really true. And in Bismarck, at the if you go to the airport, it's a small airport anyway, but when you go there, it sometimes it feels absolutely deserted. And, you know, before there was always some activity going on.
We're holding our monthly journalist roundtable. That was Monica Hannon, managing editor at KFYR-TV. Also joining us, Dave Kolpak with the Associated Press, and our Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News director. And we'll be back with more of the roundtable in just a moment.
Spend part of your Independence Day weekend with the Great American Folk Show.
Do you have fireflies up in the Dakotas?
Get a little lesson in physics.
We weren't actually being pushed by the wind, but we were being sucked forward by the lower pressure on the opposite side of the sail.
There are people risking all they have in fragile little boats.
The culinary arts.
Drop your matzo balls in. They need to sink for, you know, up to 30 seconds, but then they need to emerge from the broth to the top.
Or just take in some great music from Kenneth Pattingale of the Milk Carton Kids, Eleni Mandel, and Letitia Van Zandt. Plus a couple of songs and a small town story from acclaimed actor John C. Reilly. That's the Great American Folk Show with Tom Brousseau, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Summertime is magical.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. We're holding our journalists roundtable. We've got Dave Thompson in Bismarck, Monica Hannon in Bismarck, and Dave Kolpak and I are in Fargo. And we're talking about the pandemic's effects on just about everything, including agriculture. I was thinking, Dave Thompson, that the pandemic that we're dealing with has been sometimes referred to as from a particular place like the Chinese or Wuhan, or there are other terms for it as well, that seem to get in the way of other issues like trade. And I'm reminded that we had this sort of mini trade deal with China around soybeans and other commodities that are popularly grown in Fargo and elsewhere in North Dakota. How is the ag commodity market doing these days?
You know, I'm going to say for right now, it seems to be kind of holding its own. But I think there's another story that's not being told very often, and we're trying to tell a little bit, is that, you know, farmers are social distancers. You know, farming is, you know, not a big, huge, lots of people operation necessarily. But there are farmers who are feeling it, too, because they're wondering if there's going to be a place for the commodities to go, because a lot of that's shipped, and what is shipped? Ships use petroleum products. Petroleum products are down. Nobody's really using petroleum. There's a lot of ships that are not leaving port. So I know in talking to a few farmers, they're a bit concerned. And also, you know, they're wondering what the crop situation is going to be like, because the soybean prices have been depressed. Wheat prices have been depressed. It seems like durums is holding its own, and sugar beets, well, there was a little depressed in prices there too. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the ag industry right now, at least in, you know, central North Dakota, where there's been a kind of a drought as well. There was a decent rain today, almost an inch and a half of rain, so that helped. I think that'll help lift some spirits.
Well, I was reminded that last year when we were talking about soybeans, the big story, the big business gain was on people who were creating storage because the soybean prices simply weren't where a lot of farmers wanted them to be.
Exactly.
And they thought we'll just store them and we'll sell them when the prices improve. Well, I don't know that prices have significantly improved. We'll have to wait and see what happens this crop year. But it's a difficult issue when you're talking about a state that relies so much on commodities like oil and gas and agriculture.
Agriculture, exactly.
And they're both you know, not faring as well as they were.
You know, and that's on top of bad weather last year that forced a lot of these farmers to combine their corn just a few weeks ago. I mean, I think some of them might still be out there, right? So there's going to be a lot of fields that are going to go unplanted. You know, you talk about insult to injury with the pandemic and whatever effect that has. It's just a lot of uncertainty now.
Let's move to public and higher education and how that has been changed rather dramatically by the pandemic that has kept people at home. We've had state leaders, Monica, extolling the virtues of the state's online capacity to move instruction from the traditional classroom to the living room or bedroom or wherever. What do you think will be the result of all of this?
Well, I think that a lot of the success of the students when they're at home depends on the parent. And I have heard some parents say that there's a major difference. You can tell when the parents are actively involved in the child's education and when they're not. And I think that the children who whose parents are, for whatever reason, are not able to focus heavily on keeping the kids focused on their schoolwork are going to be left behind. And I do think that when they get back into the classroom, inevitably they're going to have to play some catch-up.
Well, there's also the issue of access. You know, when I've talked to Kirsten Baszler about this, she's downplayed it, that access is not a serious issue. But I'm thinking that access to the proper equipment and the, you know, enough bandwidth to do what needs to be done is an issue in some places. And that self-motivation beyond just the parents' motivation is also something that gets in the way of this. And I'm wondering, honestly, whether or not remedial education is going to be necessary for students who've been out of a traditional classroom for as long as these kids have.
Well, and I think that that is a concern, and they're trying to, again, maintain a positive focus. But I have heard teachers talking about the difficulty that they have in keeping kids engaged. You can kind of tell when kids are there and when they're not. And when they're not, it's how do you draw them back in?
Well, we are in a profession where we can work from home because we contact a lot of people by phone. That's traditionally how we've done a fair amount of our work. But I'm thinking about how much of my work is enhanced when I'm in an office in a, you know, surrounded by people doing the same thing, talking about that thing. And when we're in three different places, a lot of that goes away.
You know, it's interesting, too. I'll be interested to see what happens with higher education. Notre Dame, for instance, this week had announced that they were going to open their campus, but that it was going to be kind of a closed campus. Once you were on campus, you were going to stay there. And I wonder how, A, they're going to enforce that, and B, whether something similar is going to happen here in North Dakota.
Well, I can partially answer that, Monica, because the Board of Higher Education meeting today, Josh Wynn from UND, who is kind of heading this task force about, you know, the smart reopening of higher education, said that by Thursday they will have some things that are going to be procedures in place. And it looks like, for example, dormitories on some of the college campuses will not, you won't have a roommate. It'll be just single people in a dormitory room. Also, they're going to be talking about the importance of consistent testing, repeat testing, serial testing. Testing is a big thing. And also, when you come into a classroom, you probably will have your temperature taken, too. So they want to make sure that if you're sick, stay home and practice the correct hygiene with your hands and make sure that everything is A-OK when you come back to class.
Well, inevitably, somebody's going to be ill in one of those classes, and that means everybody's going to be quarantined.
Yeah, that's a distinct possibility. I know that they're trying to address that up front, but you can't address everything up front. You're probably right on that.
And you're looking at dormitories that are designed for, you know, multiple students perhaps in a particular piece of that dormitory, maybe two in a room. Maybe sometimes these are shared rooms with a common area where there are four bedrooms. That's money. That's mm-hmm. that's a revenue generating stream that helps sustain the academic ends of the university as well. So these are all complexities that I don't think anybody was really planning for.
Oh, no.
And I wonder too. I mean, can you raise tuition at a time like this? Probably not. I have heard that they are expecting enrollment to go up. And I don't know if that's just a sign of more students in general going to college, or the fact that, you know, some people like the idea of online college. And it's my understanding that it is going to be a combo platter, right, Dave? I mean, if you want to stay home and go to college, you can, right?
Yes, absolutely. But of course, the downside to that is you don't have the social interactions that you do on a college campus. And there's certain lab classes where it's really hard to do labs virtually via the internet. But there's a touting and there's a feeling that some of these classes can be done, and especially if you're going back for continuing education, you'll be able to do that via, you know, distance learning.
Well, I spent some time in higher education management, and I can recall it used to be the idea was that in times of economic uncertainty, when unemployment was higher, more people would turn up at colleges. So that was actually a generator of students. At this particular time, though, I think there's another problem out there, and you might have some students saying, well, I don't want to go back, particularly if going back just means going online. I might just take a break. And I think in the Minnesota system, for example, they are looking at a very significant decline in student populations in the fall. And they've also, as referenced earlier, they've decided to hold the line on tuition, even though that is likely to be hammered by what's going to happen. So the revenue streams, the traditional revenue streams for higher education, are severely impacted by this.
And North Dakota's Board of Higher Education talked about tuition increases, and they're saying maybe we can build something like maybe a 1-2% increase in tuition. And that's basically because the governor came down with his budget guidelines and said higher education 10% off top. That's what he's suggesting. The budget that higher education is going to propose is going to be what they call a needs-based budget. And in there, they're figuring about, again, about a 1-2% increase in tuition.
Dave, you used to cover athletics. College mm-hmm. athletics are going to be, that's an interesting conundrum right now.
Oh, it certainly is. And the interesting part is I talked to some folks today about the North Dakota State-Oregon football game. That's what everybody seems to be interested in. And right now, supposedly that game is on. But the commissioner of the Missouri Valley Conference said yesterday that, boy, there could be some interruptions here. And you combine that with the fact that Dr. Fauci just today testified that he's worried that this is going to get a lot worse. He's talking 100,000 cases a day. And so, you know, all bets might be off here with a lot of things in the next couple of months. And again, you talk about the testing people. You know, a lot of the athletes came in early to get their workouts in, and right away NDSU had an athlete, I assume was a football player, test positive. You know, are you going to be able to keep everybody healthy? I don't know.
We're conducting our journalist roundtable. It's the end of June. We have Dave Kolpak, you just heard his voice, with the Associated Press, Monica Hannon with the managing editor at KFYR-TV, and Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News director. And we'll be back with more of our discussion about what's been in the news the past month. But first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota colleges and universities are contemplating an aggressive COVID-19 testing component as students prepare to return to campuses this fall. With students coming from multiple states and countries, there is concern about a spike in caseloads. UND Medical School Dean Joshua Wynn says they are working with the state health department on establishing campus testing sites.
For students return to campus, there would be widespread surveillance testing in Fargo, Grand Forks, Minot, Bismarck, Dickinson and Williston, to be supplemented by at-home testing for students where it's not convenient to travel to one of those locations.
Wynn says the ideal situation would be to test students right before they return to campus, so if they test positive, they can isolate at home.
For students who for some reason cannot be tested ahead of time, the plan is going to include testing on campus. That obviously presents logistical challenges to the institutions when a student tests positive, because then the student is already on campus and would have to be isolated on campus.
Wynn says the state has the bandwidth to handle the testing demand.
Currently, the capacity is something like 5,000 tests a day, with the capacity to flex up to 8,000 a day. So even with a large number of students that we anticipate, the bandwidth should be there to do widespread testing.
Student athletes would likely see more intense testing due to travel plans. The testing blitz for all students could be repeated after Thanksgiving. The State Board of Higher Education has voted to submit a needs-based budget to Governor Burgum for consideration as he prepares his executive budget request for the 2021 and 2023 biennium. When Burgum issued his budget guidelines, higher education was asked to reduce its general fund request by 10%. That would come in a reduction in higher ed's funding formula. It would drop the appropriation to $574.7 million. University System Vice Chancellor for Finance Tammy Dolan told the board that amount would be lower than the appropriation higher ed received in the 2011-2013 biennium.
That's a significant drop in funding that would be extremely difficult for, if not impossible, for the institutions to manage.
University System Chancellor Mark Hagerot echoed that.
The fat is gone. They've leaned down. Now, with this shock, it's like we're going to start taking some muscle away.
The board is proposing a 1.1% increase in general fund spending. The budget includes an average of 3% pay raise per year for all university system employees. It also allows a 1.1% to 2% increase in tuition. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're holding our Journalist Roundtable with our Dave Thompson, Monica Hannon, and Dave Kolpak. And Dave Thompson, got to refer to you by the last name to get straight here. The legislature will be convening in January, and are they preparing for, you know, a lot of virtual stuff?
They are, basically. They are expecting to convene in January, but if COVID continues to rise in this country and all of a sudden we get some breakouts here, there are some Plan B steps that are being done. For example, each of the committee hearing rooms is now wired for video and sound. And you can log online and do that, and you can participate remotely as well. The legislature's chambers, both the House and Senate chambers, will have new voting boards in them. And there are going to be new ways where legislators could be at home and vote. I don't exactly know how that's going to work, but there's new technology that's coming out that's going to be installed. And this is being paid for, partially at least, by money from the CARES Act, which, you know, was set aside $1.25 billion for North Dakota, set aside for impacts from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, let's talk about local governments, our commissions, you know, the City of Fargo Commission, Bismarck's leadership. How are they? Are those meetings different now?
Well, in Bismarck, the last meeting I happened to see, four of the five commissioners were there, but they were all very much 6 feet or more distant from each other. So there's social distancing happening, but they do have the option to get online and participate that way. And in the Burley County Commission, that's been done a few times where they've had some of the commissioners in-house, but others have been on the phone or on the computer.
Monica,
so it looks different.
Monica, how has this changed the way that KFIRE reporters cover government?
We do an awful lot of phone interviews, many more than we did before. And people are, you know, Skyping on their phones, basically. And that's how we're covering them. And, you know, with television, you want to have video with what you're talking about. And so we've done a lot of graphics. You see a lot more graphics than you did in the past. But we are still going to the meetings. And, you know, again, social distancing is key. You have to, Dave knows this, like when he's covering the governor's news briefings on COVID-19, you guys are all together in the room. Some of you are masked, some of you aren't. But you make an attempt to social distance there. And I think
that
it's
is
very
correct,
similar.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's very similar to, the, you know, any other meetings that they have as well. You definitely notice it.
Let's move on to another topic. We've had a lot of social unrest in this country, particularly around the issue of the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police weeks ago now. And these protests continue. And there seems to be a movement, however slight it's happening, to actually make some fundamental changes. I'm just wondering, you know, from the North Dakota perspective, we don't necessarily see some of these color issues the way that the rest of the country does. But we do have Native Americans, and that's an issue in our state. What do you make of the protest movement that's been happening nationally and, for that matter, around us as well?
I can take that first. I think Fargo really has kind of been the leader, I guess, in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, just because of our numbers and because of the leadership, you know, I think they've done a lot of great things. You know, we were talking about how we cover things these days, and you know, about the only things I've gotten out for or to cover have been the protest in Fargo. And I've, you know, most of them have been peaceful. There was the one protest on May 30th that turned kind of ugly in downtown Fargo. But I think, you know, it's a good thing to take and examine the things you do, to examine your police force. And for the most part, the Fargo police have been open to that idea. You know, the protesters of both from Black Lives Matter and there's another group in Fargo that's also started. They unveiled a list of demands at one of their protests. And I think that was a really good starting point, and I think they had a lot of good ideas. It's taken a while before they've gotten down to discuss them seriously with city leaders. That took place last week behind closed doors, and I think they're making progress. And you know, I think when all is said and done, it's going to be a positive thing, at least from what I've seen in Fargo.
And we were reminded that the mayor of Moorhead is a Black man, and we were reminded that the mayor of Fargo has a son who's adopted, who's a Black young man. So that there is some, I think, awareness among the leadership that perhaps isn't the case in other places. We also, you know, heard about this big shakeup in the Fargo Police Department. One of the leaders of the police department is out, released shortly after that May 30th incident, and that has focused attention on, you know, reimagining policing, looking at it again, not perhaps defunding it necessarily in Fargo, but in other parts of the country, they are looking at it very seriously. In Minneapolis, the city council keeps voting to basically get rid of what was called the police department and make it into something else.
Right. That was an incident where one of the executives in the police department, during the day, he had been in his uniform. He got out of his police uniform and into civilian clothes about the time the protest really got violent, and didn't tell anybody, at least according to the police chief. He said he didn't know about it. The protesters have kind of taken a detailed look into that. The officer in question has since resigned. I think it was good that drew attention to, again, examining some of the things that are going on in the police department. I do worry right now, though, that that they're a little fixated on that one event. I mean, like I said, the officer has resigned. I think now they have bigger fish to fry. I mean, let's take a look at what the police are doing right and what they're doing wrong. And I think that's what they're doing. I think they're moving on from here. But you're right, Doug, that really drew attention to the situation.
And we have, I think, a renewed attention to who are the police? Who are the sheriffs? Do they reflect the community at large? Are they, you know, represented demographically in a way that is encouraging to people who may not be the predominant culture?
Yeah, that's I can tell you that's just a no right now. That is something that needs work.
Let's talk about politics now in North Dakota and nationally, because this is going to be one Lollapalooza of a year, 2020, with pandemics and protests and a presidential election. What stands out so far about the political rhetoric, the positioning, the sort of the circumstances we're in? And I'm going to start with our Dave Thompson.
It's interesting to watch some of the divisions in some of the parties, let's be honest. And in North Dakota, you're seeing some divisions within the Republican Party, which is kind of interesting. And there seems to be some anger by a group of people against Governor Burgum, who has this PAC that funded certain candidates. And the candidates were very successful. And then you've got groups who are agitating that they should be on the ballot even though they lost the primary. And there is a group that wants to hold a Republican convention after the primary is over and wants to do it at the end of July. It's very interesting because when I'm talking Republicans, because this is North Dakota and we're a pretty Republican state. You know, nationally, it's very, very odd that you have the pandemic has been such a damper on things, that you have not as many conventions or rallies nationally. And a lot of things are being done online and being done by ads and being done by outside groups. And all part of that, of course, is because Citizens United, kind of opened the door for a lot more money.
Well, Monica, I'm thinking about politics being sort of the business of optics. And you've got these rallies and these big political events like conventions are not a good idea necessarily in a pandemic. So this is upsetting the business as usual about politicking.
Well, it is. But on the other hand, it hasn't stopped the flow of money as far as advertising goes. I mean, there have still been some really big campaigns. There is a feeling among some that the more money you spend, you know, whether you're a well-known candidate or not, it really has to do with how much money you have to spend. And that's, I think, local and national, here in North Dakota and nationally. It's also interesting to me, and this may be a little bit off topic, but it is interesting to me when you're talking about large gatherings, that you don't want to have large gatherings because of the pandemic. And yet there are large gatherings for protests. And that's something that I think has caused a lot of comment and is be important going into this election.
I have heard that same thing, and there's been concern about whether or not after one of these big protests, whether or not there's going to be a spike in positive cases and that kind of thing. And I think we are seeing some of that in some places. It's perhaps not as pervasive as we thought it would be because maybe they're outside and maybe some of the protesters are wearing masks and things like that. But nevertheless, this is going to be a presidential year unlike any other, Dave.
If the last presidential race wasn't interesting enough, I agree. You've got the Democratic candidate who seems to be making more pace in the ratings sitting at home than he is out on the campaign trail. And now, you know, we have the case with, you know, what did the president know or not know about Russia perhaps putting bounties on the heads of U.S. soldiers, right? It's not just nationally. I think in North Dakota, I think Dave summed it up really well. I've never seen so much interest in a primary race for treasurer before.
Yeah, really.
You know, and you've got the president on one side against the governor, and Dave can probably fill me in on this. The treasurer is not a very big office, but I know it's pretty important. I know they sit on powerful state boards.
Correct. Yes.
Right alongside the governor. And I think the state land board might be one of those, which right now is, you know, all about mineral royalties, and we've had a couple interesting cases there involving minerals under Lake Sakakawea. So it's. You know, I don't cover politics full time, but this year I wish I did.
And you mentioned that treasurer also sits on the investment board, which makes decisions on things like the retirement and investment funds for state employees and the legacy fund, which could become another political football in the next session. It's one to watch.
Why was the treasurer's position so hotly contested?
Open seat, because Kelly Schmidt, who is the incumbent treasurer, said she was not going to run for re-election, and that was an opening for some people. And that's why I think it became hotly contested.
And yet, I mean, a lot of money was spent on the treasurer's position.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you kind of want to bore into why. And I guess maybe some why will be revealed at some point besides just political positioning.
Well, I think we're going to learn more about the why. I'm pretty sure we will. And it's going to be an interesting race between the two people who are running. Mark Haugen, who's been a long time, pretty much centrist type Democrat. He's been around for a long time. And then you've got Tom Beadle from Fargo, who is a legislator with some chops, too. And they're both not on the wings of their parties. So these are more centrist type candidates. I think it's going to be an interesting race.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether it's hotly contested when among the two parties as hotly as it was within the one. Let's talk a bit about the state auditor's reviews of the Commerce Department and the North Dakota State College of Science. These were somewhat controversial. And again, it's the same party. It's the Republican Party that's running all of these executive offices. Why were these so contentious?
There is some feeling that the auditor is just trying to make a name for himself, Auditor Josh Gallion. But there are others who are saying, hey, we finally have a watchdog in there to really keep an eye on money. And in terms of the Commerce Department, it more or less was ruled to be an oversight. Yes, a mistake was made, but it didn't come to the level of criminal activity because there was some worry it might. Same thing that happened with the North Dakota State College of Science, and that was a conflict of interest because their vice president for finance was married to somebody with Flint Communications who was hired to be a consultant for the North Dakota College of Science. So there was some concern about the conflict of interest there. Anyway, what happened is that the Board of Higher Education and NDSES came to an agreement that there was going to be an improvement plan. And they just signed off on the improvement plan this week, saying changes have been made, things will go forward from here. In terms of commerce, well, they decided that there will be no further action at this point.
Well, in both cases, when an auditor, the state auditor, says we're going to look deeply at your operation, that costs money. And I think the Commerce Department is basically asking for some reimbursement, isn't it?
This is actually for legal fees that a couple of the officials felt they had to have legal counsel to stand by just in case there was any effort to file any criminal charges. In the end, they didn't file criminal charges, so now they're looking for reimbursement for the money they spent.
Monica, does this get talked about much in Bismarck or around your news desk?
Yeah, when it was going on, right in the middle of it, we had quite a number of conversations concerning it, and the very same questions that Dave brought up. You know, what's behind it? Is Gallion trying to make a name for himself? And what's his future going to be? But after all was said and done, I wondered how much of this is business as usual with the business as usual now changing.
You know, I know the governor has said that the auditor has kind of created an atmosphere of fear with a lot of these audits that he's done. But now you've got the two people from Commerce that were questioned asking for money from the state. And now if they get money, you know, in that case, what's that going to do to the auditor? I mean, is he going to want to bring some of these cases if the state's going to be slapped with legal fees?
And that's the weird thing. The way things set up, the auditor makes a recommendation. It's the attorney general who signs off on whether or not there's going to be legal action. But in this case, the attorney general sent it to South Dakota because he's part of the state government where the audit was done and where the agency who was audited lies. So it's a little bit convoluted.
We'll leave it with that tangle there. Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News Director, joined by Monica Hannon, Managing Editor at KFYR-TV, and Dave Kolpak with the Associated Press. Thank you all for joining us for our Journalist Roundtable.
You got it, Doug.
Thank you.
Coming up, Natural North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141-member rural electric systems in 9 states. And by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Our warm season is briefer than most places in the U.S., and as a result, we particularly appreciate the green of spring and summer. Chuck Lura is the writer and voice behind the Natural North Dakota features you hear on our show, and today he offers some insights into dead patches of grass. He says a beetle may be the problem.
Walking across a grassland or turf grass in the early parts of the growing season, a person may occasionally observe some dead patches of grass. Some of those patches of dead grass even appear to have been dug up by some animal. What's going on here? Some of those dead spots may be due to June beetles, or what some of you know as June bugs. I've noticed a few in our area recently. Most everyone's familiar with this insect, but not so much when it comes to their life cycle and ecology. Most species of June beetles have a 3-year life cycle, in which the larvae spend most of 3 growing seasons underground feeding on the root systems of plants. As the common name indicates, the adults are active around June. Following mating, the female lays her eggs in the soil. After the eggs hatch, the larvae spend the better part of the next 3 years chewing up plant roots while passing through 3 instars or developmental stages. The final stage of these larvae is commonly known as a white grub. They're white to cream colored with a dark posterior, a little over an inch long, and curled up, or C-shaped. Adult June beetles feed on the foliage of various trees and shrubs. In pastures in our state, a common food item is western snowberry, also known as buckbrush. Kentucky bluegrass is often associated with patches of western snowberry, and because the adults are weak flyers, the eggs often are deposited in areas with abundance of Kentucky bluegrass. Kentucky bluegrass, of course, is the ubiquitous lawn grass that has invaded extensive areas of our native prairies. White grubs can do a lot of damage in pastures, parks, lawns, and other areas. Larval density in the top few inches of soil may approach 5 per square foot. Most of these heavily damaged areas are almost bare of vegetation, with most of the roots having been consumed. A person can work their fingers into the ground and roll back the top few inches of this dead sod like a carpet. And as you might expect, skunks, raccoons, and some other animals find the grubs quite tasty, further disturbing the site with their diggings. So as you travel about, be on the lookout for evidence of these white grub infestations. You may even be able to dig a bit and expose the white grubs or larvae of these June beetles. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Join us every Thursday for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
I'm just so excited because it's springtime. I can't wait to get out there in the dirt.
She has some great tips for planting.
If you can go outside without your clothes on, it's time to plant your garden.
And there's stories of kitchen disasters.
You have to get like a jackknife or something to scrape it off your woodwork.
She says you should always be prepared
in the event of a zombie apocalypse.
But she's also optimistic.
The moose are pooping. It's all good, man.
And she's inspirational.
Why would you mow a lawn when you could grow a garden, for crying out loud?
That's Sue Balcom on Main Street, Thursdays at 3 and 7 Central. Don't miss it.
That would be bad, 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 bad.
And you can also subscribe to our Main Street Eats podcast.
What a brilliant idea. Oh my gosh.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 30th. On this date in the year 2000, John Lohman retired from his 48-year-long career at the Fargo Forum. Mr. Lohman was born in 1935 in Bismarck, but he grew up in Fargo and graduated from NDSU with a degree in engineering. In 1947, he became a newspaper carrier for the Forum. In 1948, he helped out by relaying election returns to the newsroom for the Dewey Truman presidential race. He continued to work for the Fargo Forum while in college, and upon graduating, decided he would not use his engineering degree but would stay with the newspaper. He worked his way up from night copy boy to associate editor and outdoors editor. Mr. Lohman's biggest claim to fame was the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the 1957 Fargo tornado. In the late evening on June 20th in 57, an F5 tornado struck the town, killing 12 people, destroying over 300 homes, displacing over 2,000 people, and causing $20 million in damage. Within minutes, Mr. Lohman and the 19 other Fargo Forum staff members arrived at the office. 5 hours and 29 minutes after the tornado struck, a special edition of the paper came hot off the presses. Mr. Lohman was the youngest member of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team. The prize committee commended the forum for its swift, vivid, and detailed news and picture coverage under considerable difficulty in overcoming many handicaps. A small but skilled staff put out a complete tornado edition within 5 hours after the disaster. In 1966, Mr. Lohman began covering the outdoor scene. He had a weekly column in every Sunday forum from 1966 to 2000. He never missed a week, even while on vacation. In 1997, he guided the coverage of the devastating flood of the Red River. Mr. Lohman was the last surviving member of the Fargo Forum's Pulitzer Prize-winning team. He died in 2018 at the age of 82, survived by his wife of 55 years and 4 children. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Listen to NPR News at work, even if you're working in your slippers. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home.
You've got not one, but two streams of Prairie Public to choose from on your smart speaker. Just ask it and listen.
People inside immigration detention centers are especially at risk from COVID-19.
There's no way to be safely detained during a pandemic.
Lawyers want to get their clients better protection or even freedom.
ICE should continue to release people, especially those who are medically vulnerable to COVID-19, to prevent a humanitarian disaster.
What the options are on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk with Claudia Berg. She retires today as the director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota, and we'll talk with the new director, Bill Peterson, who starts July 1st. Tom Eason will have a Plains Folk essay, and Tom Brousseau will talk about the third episode of The Great American Folk Show, which airs Sunday. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.